If you had the smartest Wi-Fi, it'd be Xfinity. It would boost speeds to the devices that needed them most and protect you from threats at home and online. Xfinity. Imagine that. Restrictions apply.
Hello and welcome to Newsday on the BBC World Service with Anne Soy in Nairobi and James Cocknell in London.
As Thailand and Cambodia launch military attacks across their shared border, they are also involved in a war of words, accusing each other of instigating fighting. We heard earlier from the Cambodian government, and in a moment we'll speak to the Thai representative.
Many European nations have experienced a growth in support for far-right parties in recent years. There's also a trend of such groups attempting to soften their image to appear more mainstream. We are going to hear from Jordan Badea, the leader of the National Rally in France.
And the Venezuelan Nobel Peace Prize winner Maria Corina Machado will not be in attendance in Norway to receive her prize. As the leader of the opposition to Venezuelan leader Nicolas Maduro, she has been in hiding for 11 months. That and more after the latest world news.
Hello, I'm Moira Alderson with the BBC News. More than 500,000 people have now been forced from their homes in Thailand and Cambodia as the border conflict escalates. Thousands of Cambodian rockets have been fired into Thailand, while Thai airstrikes on Cambodian positions have continued, including three casinos believed to be used as military command centres. Our correspondent Jonathan Head is in Surin on the Thai side of the border.
In the last 24, 36 hours, there have been sustained rocket attacks coming from the Cambodian side. According to the Thai military, thousands of rockets have been fired, many more on Tuesday than on Monday. That means it's not safe. Those rockets are an inaccurate weapon. In the previous conflict, they killed a number of civilians. So in advance of that, in preparation, people were very quickly moved away from those border villages. They're small-scale farmers. They've had to leave their livestock behind, their homes behind.
Amazon has announced plans to double its investment in India by 2030, spending a further $35 billion. It says the investment will create 1 million new jobs. More details from Arunde Mukherjee in Delhi.
Amazon sees Asia's third largest economy as a key market. It envisages this new investment will focus on AI-driven digitization and job creation. Big tech US firms like Microsoft and Google too have poured billions into India this year for AI advancement, ramping up infrastructure and data centers. India is still playing catch-up in the global AI race. The country's ambitions have faced numerous challenges, from semiconductor availability to skilled talent. Countries like China and the US have spent billions in research and development, critical funding that India has so far lacked.
Member states of Europe's main human rights body, the Council of Europe, meet today for talks which could overhaul the way human rights law treats migration. They'll be considering whether the law can be interpreted to make it easier to target people smugglers. Dominic Casciani has more.
The meeting of 46 states comes after growing tension over how human rights laws apply to migration, but also behind-the-scenes momentum to make changes. Officials at the Council of Europe, the body that oversees the court, believe a political declaration could be reached by the spring over how human rights laws should apply in a far more restrictive way to people smugglers and failed migrants. That deal would aim to make it harder for people to resist being sent home and potentially easier for governments to set up so-called returns hubs for those with nowhere else safe to go.
The Nobel Institute says Venezuela's opposition leader Maria Corina Machado won't attend her Peace Prize award ceremony in Oslo today. Her whereabouts are currently unknown. She spent months in hiding in Venezuela after the socialist authorities accused her of sedition for questioning the contentious results of the last election. BBC News. President Zelensky has said US and European security guarantees would be needed for Ukraine to hold elections, despite saying legislation could be changed to permit a vote under martial law. The Ukrainian leader has come under pressure from Donald Trump, who's been repeating the Russian viewpoint that a lack of elections means his country is not democratic. Australia's Prime Minister Anthony Albanese has said the new social media ban for children is a proud moment and will go down in history as a great reform. Under-16s have found themselves locked out of their accounts on 10 platforms, including TikTok and Snapchat. Mr. Albanese said his country was leading the world.
This is indeed a proud day to be Australian, because make no mistake, this reform will change lives for Australian kids and allowing them to just have their childhood, for Australian parents, enabling them to have greater peace of mind.
The lower house of Brazil's Congress has approved a bill that may drastically reduce the jail sentence given to ex-president Jair Bolsonaro for plotting a coup after his 2022 election defeat. Last month, the far-right former leader began serving a 27-year term for the assault on government buildings in Brasilia. But if the new bill is passed by the Senate, the sentence for the 70-year-old would be cut to between 2 and 3 years. Jordan Bardella, the leader of France's far-right National Rally Party, has told the BBC that he agrees with much of President Trump's recent national security strategy, which speaks of the civilizational erasure of Europe. Speaking to the BBC during a visit to Britain, the 30-year-old said Western democracies were undergoing a wind of national pride epitomised in the US by Mr. Trump. BBC News.
Thank you very much for that news. Hello and welcome to Newsday on the BBC World Service. Anne Soy is in Nairobi. I'm James Cotnell in London.
In the programme today, we'll get the latest on the conflict between Thailand and Cambodia in just a second. And we are receiving your messages on that. Vayuman Ayuba Sheriff in Philadelphia says that dialogue is the best way between Cambodia and Thailand. War would be regrettable.
Yeah, and Amara Alpha in Sierra Leone says world leaders must intervene in the ongoing border war between Thailand and Cambodia before it goes beyond anyone's expectations.
We'll also talk to the leading candidate in the race to become France's next president.
And we're going to hear about Venezuela and why the major opposition figure, Maria Cortina Machado, who has received the or has been awarded the Nobel Peace Prize, is not going to make the Peace Prize ceremony after all. You can send us your thoughts on that. Indeed, anything you hear, our number for your WhatsApp and text messages is +44 77 86 20 50 85.
Let's begin this hour with that conflict in between the Thailand and Cambodian border, and clashes there have intensified despite a fragile ceasefire agreed last October. At least 10 people have been killed and hundreds of thousands displaced in both countries as fighting continues to spread across several provinces on both sides. Thailand's Air Force has confirmed carrying out further airstrikes on Tuesday, saying that they were aimed at what it calls military targets, but did not provide operational details. Cambodia has accused Thai forces of indiscriminately shelling civilian areas in the Pursat province, a claim which Thailand strongly denies, accusing Cambodian troops of breaching the joint declaration signed to prevent further violence. President Donald Trump, who spearheaded that truce in October, says that he'll be calling the Cambodian and Thai leaders later today. Let's now speak to Nikondach Balankura. He's the spokesperson for Thailand's Ministry of Foreign Affairs. He's joining us from Bangkok. Welcome to the program. Mr. Trump has spoken about calling the leaders of both countries. How is your country preparing for this call?
Yes, regarding the phone call proposal, I have to say that as up until now, we have not been contacted by the United States side to establish a phone call between the leaders of two countries. I've seen this proposal circulated in social media, yes, but up until now, we haven't received any formal request for a phone call to take place today, as reported. Firstly,
is there still room for diplomacy?
Well, I have to say that the road for diplomacy right now is very, very narrow, or it's one can say that it's the diplomatic route is closed for the moment.
Why so?
Because, Thailand has been a victim of breaches of the, has, you know, Cambodia has breached the ceasefire, has violated the ceasefire, the joint declaration.
Cambodia accuses you of the same thing, of violating the ceasefire.
Oh, that can be verified because we, both sides have established the ASEAN Observer Team, which is an independent a mechanism to oversee that. On the 10th of November, you know, there were new landmines being laid in the Thai territory, and that was followed by numerous other violations. We even went to the Geneva to the attend the Ottawa Convention and presented United Nations with facts and figures and small footages that that proves that Thailand has been a victim of that violation.
Well, Cambodia says that landmines should not be a cause to go to war. And you know, they were talking about that incident where your soldiers were the victims of landmines along the border.
As I mentioned a bit earlier, that landmine is precisely the reason why we, Thailand, cannot tolerate Cambodia's action, because not only is not, we're not talking about one soldier, but we're talking about seven Thai soldiers whose leg has been amputated, and that was and we've exercised a lot of patience, a lot of restraint, and told Cambodia that this must stop. And up until the 10th of November, yet again, the Cambodian had led new landmines. Landmines are inhumane, you know, and that is not tolerable. I think the Cambodian has crossed and not, has crossed a line, yes.
Cambodia says that it is ready for talks but wants Thailand to initiate them. But you say this door is closed. So where does this leave the last ceasefire agreement? And where do you go from here?
What is required right now for us is for Cambodia to simply stop violating. We think the Cambodian must change their behavior. We think the Cambodian must change their way of thinking, their mindset. They have to stop repeating the same mistake. Again, we have entered into talks several times. This is not the first time that there's been proposal for talks, but we have to, you know, learn from our mistakes. Otherwise, when or how can we be assured that the Cambodians will not repeat the same mistake yet again?
But what needs to happen to end this war?
Well, this war, this clash will end with talks, I'm sure. But when can one be ready to talk? That's another question. I can tell you when is when we feel ready that our sovereignty is not compromised. And for now, we have been, the Ministry of Foreign Affairs of Thailand have been in close coordination with the, our defense, and until now, we must say that we are not safe. We feel
right.
Very much unsafe. Yes.
Thank you very much for speaking to Newsday. Nikon Dutch Balankura, the spokesperson for Thailand's Ministry of Foreign Affairs, joining us from Bangkok.
Jordan Bardella, 30-year-old, who's currently topping the polls to become France's next president in the 2027 elections, is trying to persuade the world that his National Rally Party is now mainstream, despite its far-right history. Part of that effort was a visit to London this week to meet one of the most prominent far-right and populist leaders in Britain, Nigel Farage. While Mr. Bardella was here, he sat down with the BBC's Nick Robinson on the Political Thinking podcast for an in-depth conversation, some of which you're about to hear. Our colleague Nick started by asking Mr. Bardella for a response to the US President Donald Trump's national security strategy and the suggestion that its promotion of patriotic parties in Europe is referring to parties like his National Rally.
Écoutez, je crois qu'il y a un vent de liberté, de fierté nationale qui est en train de souffler sur tout.
Listen, I believe there is a wind of freedom and national pride blowing across all major Western democracies. And it is true that President Trump in the United States was an expression of that current stream of ideas of that great popular movement. Trump defends his country's interests. What I criticize French leaders for, and European leaders more broadly, is for not defending their country's interest strongly enough. It is true that Trump was giving a nod to patriotic parties around the world, and I welcome that with a certain goodwill. But as for me, I wish to defend the interest of my country tomorrow. I do not like this vassalization of Europe towards any great power. Ultimately, my project is both the greatness, the freedom, and the independence of France and of Europe.
Do you agree with the language that is used in this strategy document by the United States? It says there's a very real prospect of civilizational erasure. It warns that European countries could become majority non-European. Is that your view?
Oui, en grande partie, je partage ce constat. D'abord, je me réjouis que...
Yes, to a large extent, I share that assessment. First of all, I am pleased that France and Europe, far beyond their borders, are capable of speaking to the hearts and consciences of people around the world. You know what struck me? It was during one of the most dramatic events our country has experienced in the past decade, the fire at Notre Dame Cathedral in Paris. This tragedy moved people and consciences all over the world. And I believe that France is truly itself when it can speak in its universal vocation to all hearts and all minds across the globe. It is true that mass immigration and the laxity of our leaders over the past 30 years regarding migration policies are today disrupting the power balance of European societies, Western societies, and particularly the French society.
There are politicians all over Europe who could say what you say, but you go much further. You talk about the European people disappearing. You talk about French people being submerged by migrants. Let's focus on what you're doing here. You've been a busy man. You've been to Israel to visit the Holocaust Museum. You've been wooing French business leaders. You've been meeting with The Economist magazine. You're now here at the BBC. You're trying to say to people, we're not extremists anymore. We're not racists anymore.
Oui, c'est en tout cas de...
Yes, it is in any case about fighting against the caricatures made of my political movement, of my ideas, of its members, activists and parliamentarians. I lead a political party, the National Rally, thanks to the trust given to me by Marine Le Pen. And it is today the leading political party in France. And today, in every poll and every voting intention published in France, we are the party predicted to win the next legislative elections and the next presidential election. So my responsibility is obviously to bring the French people together and to present the country with a project of national recovery. Because my country, France, is in an economic, social, financial, budgetary and security situation that is extremely difficult. And this means that expectations for change and disruption are extremely high among my people, among the French people.
You call it a cliché about your party. It's a fact. Your party was a racist party. It is the history of the National Rally. After it stopped being the National Front, Jean-Marie Le Pen described the gas chambers used by the Nazis to murder millions of Jews in this continent as a footnote in history. To be taken seriously, do you not need to say to people, we were a racist party, we need to change?
Je rejette ces accusations.
I reject these accusations, because there has never been, in the DNA or in the proposal of the National Front, now the National Rally, any statements or proposals intending to harm or offend groups of people in my country. However, it is true that there were remarks notably made by Jean-Marie Le Pen, which eventually caused a political rupture between Jean-Marie Le Pen, the party's founder, and Marine Le Pen, then its president. On the key issue of fighting anti-Semitism, she judged that Jean-Marie Le Pen's ambiguities and verbal provocations were dragging the entire political movement into an unacceptable situation. And so in 2015, Marine Le Pen, as I remind you, took the responsibility, an extremely difficult personal decision, of expelling her own father from the National Front.
The National Rally's Jordan Bardella speaking to BBC's Nick Robinson.
Let's get some sports news now with Sarah Manai in London.
Dominic Soboslai's late penalty gave Liverpool a crucial 1-0 win against Inter Milan in the Champions League last night. Barcelona won 2-0 at the Camp Nou against German side Eintracht Frankfurt. Elsewhere, Chelsea lost 2-1 in Bergamo, despite João Pedro's first goal in the Champions League. Tonight, Arsenal have a trip to Bruges, PSG to go to Bilbao, while Real Madrid host Manchester City. More on this in half an hour's time. I'm going to give you a last news in Formula One. Red Bull advisor Helmut Marko will leave the team after 20 years at the end of 2025. He had been crucial in supporting the development of drivers like Max Verstappen and Sebastian Vettel.
Sarah Manai, thank you. Now let's head to our business desk in Singapore and speak to Nick Marsh. Because, Nick, you're looking at one of our main stories this hour. Microsoft saying it's going to pour billions of dollars into India.
Absolutely, yes. Major investment, $17.5 billion to be precise. And what they're going to pour it into? Well, artificial intelligence. What else? You kind of get numb sometimes, James, after a while looking at these figures. But it is quite interesting because it's a major investment in India, which doesn't always get too much attention. We talk about the US, we talk about China quite a lot. But Microsoft's chief executive, Satya Nadella, born and raised in India himself, actually, was meeting with Narendra Modi. He made the announcement that they're going to be investing in massive new data centers, expanding existing ones. They're going to embed Microsoft's AI into national platforms, which are highly digitalized already, actually, and huge. Let's not forget, you know, more than a billion people. And he said a lot of money would also go into people, you know, training the workforce. So a very big investment. Actually, it's on top of the $3 billion that Microsoft already announced in January this year.
Nick, thank you very much indeed.
Now, it's more than 18 years since the start of one of the most high-profile missing persons stories in modern history, when British 3-year-old Madeleine McCann went missing during a family holiday in Portugal. What followed were years of intense press scrutiny for her parents and family members, who are caught between their private grief and the need to maintain public interest in the search for their missing daughter. What came with that tension is that in their telling is years of abuse at the hands of the press, from the constant presence of journalists around their home to physical intimidation and printing without retraction or apology of mistruths. Madeleine's parents, Jerry and Kate McCann, have long pushed for media accountability in order to protect others. Here's what Jerry McCann had to say when he spoke to the BBC.
I think it's just really important that we want to meet with the Prime Minister. Many people in the Labour Party made us promises, and we're over a year into the government and there haven't been any changes. Ordinary people need protection from the press. You know, press regulation is no longer a priority. People's lives are being damaged, destroyed on a daily basis, and it's simply not acceptable. There is a regulator out there in press, and hundreds of local newspapers and others have signed up, but not the major titles. We want that basically put into law so that we have protection, an independently regulated press, similar to what we have with broadcasters.
You use the phrase in your letter, press abuses. Do you mind just describing the sorts of activities, behaviour, quote-unquote abuses you're actually wanting to raise attention on?
I think most people are familiar with the term I would use, which is monstering, where someone's on the front page of the news, and happened to us with Madeleine, and for many months after is where we had the press camped, journalists coming to the house, photographers literally ramming their cameras against our car window when we had 2-year-old twins in the back That sort of thing is so disturbing. But there are many other forms. It's the half-truths. It's the making up of stories to fit the agenda rather than the truth, which destroys people's lives. It's so damaging, and we need that protection. There has to be redress. And at the minute, for most of these mainstream media, there is no redress. They don't investigate. They don't uphold complaints. And more importantly, the people who oversaw the culture of phone hacking and blagging, they're still in power. They're still doing it. And we believe the culture has not changed. Madeline's been missing for 18 years, and the bottom line is we don't know what's happened to her. There is no evidence, and I don't even mean convincing evidence, there is no evidence to say she's dead. Now, we fully understand she may be dead, it may even be probable, but we don't know that. And if you were in a, you know, even if you were going to a court of law, if someone said to me now, are you confident beyond reasonable doubt that Madeline's dead? The answer's no. I don't know. I mean, I think it's more than probable, but not beyond reasonable doubt.
A spokesperson for press regulator IPSO told the BBC that it can intervene directly in cases of press harassment. It says, he says, we encourage anyone with concerns about press behaviour to contact us for help.
It is Newsday on the BBC World Service with Anne in Nairobi and James in London. And we're getting reports coming through from Norway that the Venezuelan opposition leader, Maria Corina Machado, who has been awarded this year's Nobel Peace Prize, will not, after all, be attending the ceremony in Oslo later today. She has been in hiding since last year's disputed election in Venezuela, which she and other opposition party members and leaders say was stolen. The Nobel Institute had previously expected her to attend the ceremony in person. It is now thought that her daughter will represent her instead. The Venezuelan authorities had said that if she did travel to Norway for that ceremony, she would be considered a fugitive. Well, a short while ago, I spoke to José Enrique Arrioja, the Venezuelan managing editor of America's Quarterly. For more on Ms. Machado, on her being awarded the Nobel Peace Prize, and the current situation in Venezuela.
The interesting element in all of this, besides and beyond the symbolism, is the fact that, you know, this one may be actually opening a new door, a sort of like a new phase into this crisis between the U.S. And Venezuela, and eventually, you know, more leaders, more regional leaders will actually coalesce in a, you know, firmer, more solid way around what, you know, Maria Corina Machado signifies, and by extension, the elected president, Edmundo González, no? So, but again,
you say elected president, he obviously hasn't been sworn in. The opposition believes he's won, the US and many others do, but he's not president right now in real terms.
Correct, because the lack of, you know, the ceremony, the inauguration, or his inauguration that was supposed to, you know, originally take place back in January the 10th of this year, no?
You say what Maria Corina Machado represents. Mm-hmm. What is that exactly, do you think?
This deep desire within, you know, most of Venezuela populations to actually, you know, turn the page of this more than 27 years of this socialist revolution that started with Chavez and since 2013 with Maduro, to just finally say goodbye, right, to an economic debacle that we haven't seen in the Western Hemisphere outside times of war, you know, in centuries, all right? So that specific possibility of changing, transitioning to democracy at some point is what gives a special relevance and a special meaning to what Maria Corina embodies and signifies for the regular Venezuelans.
The thoughts there of José Enrique Arrioja, the Venezuelan managing editor of the publication America's Quarterly. We've had a message in from Dr. Kaesong saying it's a shame that Machado will not be in attendance to receive her Nobel Prize today. Dr. Kaesong thinks that's because of concerns for her safety. Plenty more to come here on Newsday.
Distribution of the BBC World Service in the United States is made possible by American Public Media, producer and distributor of award-winning public radio content, engaging audiences, creating meaningful experiences, and fostering conversations. APM, American Public Media, with support from Odoo, offering software that provides building blocks for creating a custom software suite. Odoo, what small businesses need.
Support for KQED comes from European Sleepworks, the store that bases its design and materials on research factors affecting sleep, including comfort and support, humidity levels, and ease of breathing. Details online about their mattresses and bedding at sleepworks.com. Jan Schramm and Maria Minetti Schramm, founders of the Minetti Schramm Museum at UC Davis, featuring Sahar Curry, Weights and Measures, at a January 24th gala celebration, supporting the museum's educational programs.
Hello, welcome to Newsday with Anne Soy in Nairobi and James Cotton in London.
In this half hour, we'll hear about the recovery and rebuilding efforts more than a month after the devastation of Hurricane Melissa in Jamaica.
We'll hear accusations that the warring parties in Sudan are using child soldiers.
And speak to a relative of a Kenyan police officer who's been missing in Haiti for months. But first, this news.
BBC News with Moira Alderson. More than 500,000 people have now been forced from their homes in Thailand and Cambodia as the border conflict there escalates. Donald Trump says he expects to make a phone call to the country's leaders, whom he pressurised into a ceasefire in July. Amazon has announced plans to double its investment in India by 2030, spending a further $35 billion on expanding exports of goods and strengthening its artificial intelligence capabilities. The e-commerce giant says the investment will create 1 million new jobs on the subcontinent. Member states of Europe's main human rights body, the Council of Europe, meet today for talks which could overhaul the way human rights law treats migration. Several European leaders back moves to make it easier to target people smugglers and set up return hubs for migrants. The Nobel Institute says Venezuela's opposition leader, Maria Corina Machado, won't attend her Peace Prize award ceremony in Oslo today. She spent months in hiding after the socialist authorities accused her of sedition. The lower house of Brazil's Congress has approved a bill that may lead to a drastic reduction in the jail sentence now being served by ex-president Jair Bolsonaro for plotting a coup. Last month, the far-right former leader began serving a 27-year term. Jordan Bardella, the leader of France's far-right National Rally Party, has told the BBC he agrees with much of President Trump's recent national security strategy, which speaks of the civilizational erasure of Europe. Australia's Prime Minister, Anthony Albanese, has said the new social media ban for children is a proud moment and will go down as a great reform in history. But even on day one, correspondents say it's clear many are finding their way around the restrictions. That's the latest BBC News.
Thank you for that news. Hello and welcome to Newsday on the BBC World Service with James Copnall in London and me, Anne Soy, in Nairobi.
Yeah, and we've got plenty to come in this next half hour. We're going to bring you stories from Jamaica, Sudan and Kenya.
And in sport, we'll look at why tonight's Champions League clash between Manchester City and Real Madrid could be pivotal for the Real Madrid manager. Let's return now to Jamaica and the devastation caused by Hurricane Melissa in October. If you were listening to the program yesterday, you would have heard us speak to sprint legend Asafa Powell about his work to help rebuild the country after Melissa swept through the Caribbean island. Today we are hearing from Reverend Conard Thomas, a pastor at St. James Baptist Church in Salt Spring, Montenegro Bay, on Jamaica's north coast. His church was severely damaged when the storm hit, and reconstruction work has not yet begun. But alongside members of the local community, efforts are underway to clear the debris. St. James Baptist Church is located in a fairly poverty-stricken part of Salt Spring. The level of crime, including violent incidents, is pretty high. The church, for many in the area, is not just a place of worship. It also helps local youth who are at risk to avoid violence through its Peace and Justice Center. Well, earlier I caught up with Reverend Thomas and began by asking him about the difficulties both he and the community are facing with getting life back to normal.
It has been difficult. We are still without electricity. We are still without water. And we're still struggling with, you know, poor connectivity. We have to be going to the river to get water and to wash our clothes and to get water for domestic use. There's a congregation at the river. Persons who I didn't know in my community, I met them at the river. So the river is this... is my new congregation, mm. You know, and you could just find people helping one another. And the water is just so forceful at the river.
How is it for you now? Are you able to congregate perhaps by the churches? How are you leading services now?
We had another building that we call the Peace and Justice Center, of course, our community. It's more than just a church that we offer there. It's a hub for other activities. And so we are now meeting in that center for worship. The congregation, we are coming out, and in that service, we allow people to speak, to give testimony of their experience, of God's goodness, of God's grace, of the trauma. You can find people breaking down in worship as they share the horrors of their experience with Hurricane Melissa. But we are able to worship in the Peace and Justice Center that was spared because it was concrete roof. It was not zinc like the church. We're using our voice. We have no instrument. We have no microphone. We have no electricity. So the worship is tighter. It is closer. And it is more real. There's a measure of rejoicing, you know, after the aftermath of Hurricane Melissa when we now meet.
And even as there's that measure of rejoicing, which is very, it's very good to hear. What Yes. are the biggest needs of your community at the moment?
The biggest need right now, I would say, is survival, food. The people, they do need food. They do need like tarpaulin. They need to have their roofs replaced, their property replaced. They just need a sense of rebuilding. So people need food, water, some needs clothes. People need to pick the pieces up again and go. So that's the biggest need, just to get themselves back together.
Has any of that support been coming to you?
Yes, we do have persons who from overseas, they are sending food items. So we do have care packages to give out to people. But beyond that, people need short-term help, medium-term help, and long-term help. You know, you can get a care package and that might last you for a day or two. But beyond that, we need more sustained, resilient assistance for persons to get back on their feet.
What are your fears about the future and, you know, how climate is impacting lives?
The strength of this hurricane, it matters not how we prepare. It was beyond our preparation. This hurricane was beyond our preparation. It was so angry and powerful that irrespective of the kind of preparation we would have done, it just removed it. And so I believe the way forward is that we will have to, you know, build more hurricane resilient shelters. And this is the kind of experience that Melissa has given us. And I trust that the government will take heed and to prepare better for future hurricanes.
What's your message to the world, given what your country has gone through, what your communities have gone through, in light of, you know, how climate is changing? What's your message to the world?
I want the world to know that Jamaica is an island of beautiful, resilient people. We may be small, but we are strong, and we welcome partnerships and support to help rebuild not just our churches, but our homes, to help rebuild lives of families who lost everything. I believe that together we can turn this moment of devastation into a testimony of restoration.
Reverend Conard Thomas speaking to me earlier about recovery post Hurricane Melissa in Jamaica.
Now, as we have done so often over the last couple of years on Newsday, let's turn our attention to the war in Sudan, the world's worst humanitarian crisis. The fighting is currently concentrated in the southwestern region of Kordofan. Across Sudan, the war is largely fought between the army and the paramilitary group, the Rapid Support Forces. But there's a third major player in Kordofan, the SPLM North Armed Group, which has recently allied itself with the RSF. Well, a veteran human rights activist from South Kordofan has accused the RSF and SPLM North of forcing children to fight for them. So I spoke to Hafiz Mohammed, who runs Justice Africa Sudan, for more.
I think what Sudan Liberation Army movement and Rapid Support Forces is trying to do is try to mobilize as much as they can in terms of soldiers. And I don't think, because they are launching a massive attack in South Kordofan, West Kordofan, and North Kordofan. And this is why they are actually forcing, some young men in the areas controlled by them to go for training and join the fight. That is the main reason. And they're doing it in most of the areas controlled by SPLM in different parts of South Kordofan, specifically the case which I'm talking about in the eastern part of South Kordofan, in three localities, called Karshola locality, Rashad locality, and Al-Tagar locality. And these specifically areas controlled by them. They have two counties there. They call them Tegeli County and Rashad County. And then there is traditional gold mining in these areas. And most of these people have been actually arrested or kidnapped from gold minings and then sent to the training camps.
And presumably they don't have any choice, any way of escaping that sort of situation.
No, they don't have any way of escaping. And in one area, actually, they came to the elders and they asked them to provide them with fighters. Try to negotiate with them to hand them some of the young people to join the fight. And that way many of young people, especially secondary school age and others, they all flee. They left the areas because fear of, being arrested. And the people who stayed there, who are being apprehended or arrested and kidnapped and taken to the training camps.
You have been covering conflicts, reporting on human rights violations in Sudan for decades. How widespread has the use of child soldiers been over this time?
It is. So all the warring factions are using children. Even Sudan Armed Forces and the militia allied with Sudan Armed Forces are using children. They don't care. They only just want as much as they can in terms of soldiers to fight. They don't care much about, the age and all the international convention or rules which is governing use of child soldiers and all these things.
And what sort of impact does this have on children, the ones who are forced to fight?
Definitely, they just end their future. And they cut their education. They're not going to continue education. And also, because they are young. And vulnerable. You just have to engage in killing, fighting, even the sound of the guns and the war. It is difficult for them to familiarize themselves with, and which have psychological impact, social impact, and also serious impact on the future of these children.
How would you describe the situation in general in the Kordofan region right now? It seems to be the hot spot of a lot of conflict, really, in Sudan after Darfur. Now it's in Kordofan. What's it like there right now?
It's so bad because the war is especially in South Kordofan, North Kordofan, and West Kordofan. The war is in all the parts of the regions. There's no exceptions. And also in South Kordofan, it's specifically because of there's no humanitarian assistance. People managed to actually cultivate them of their lands. And now is the harvest, especially for crops like sorghum, which people rely on it mainly on their food. And now is a harvest season. And with the launching military offensive during this, that means you're going to destroy the harvest, the crops, and people end up, you know, starving. And that's exactly what's happening now. And even with kidnapping of young men, now in some areas, especially in Tigray area, people don't have any laborers to actually cultivate the sorghum. And that will have a very severe impact. And the war is just all over the places now, all the regions. And the main problem is the drones attacks now. You know, that we have drone attack every day from SPLM North or Arab Support Force or Sudan Armed Forces. They're continuously attacking, civilians, areas, killing civilians in Kadugli, in Kalogi, more than 40 people, include children in a nursery being hit in a Kashola every day. That just in 1 week, like we have more than 7 attacks continuously from all the warring factions, the government, the soldiers, RSF, and Rapid Support Force.
Hafiz Mohammed there, who runs the rights group Justice Africa, Suzanne, veteran observer of conflict and human rights abuses in his country. And we've had a few messages in on this, including from Dada Kamara in the Gambia, who says the allegations into the use of child soldiers in Sudan is worrying and disturbing. And this is why there's an urgent need for the warring parties to set aside their differences and bring an end to this unnecessary war. Dauda says the Sudanese deserve peace and nothing less. And B.W. Bokari in Freetown, Sierra Leone, says, I keep asking myself why the war in Sudan keeps escalating as if that country is not part of the global community. B.W. Bokari makes the point that peacekeeping forces are sent elsewhere, but the insecurity in Sudan continues unabated. All right, let's get the sports now with Sarah Manai.
And let's head to Spain, because Xabi Alonso's fate at Real Madrid has not yet been decided. But tonight's Champions League game against Manchester City at the Bernabeu could prove crucial for the Spanish manager. Having won just one of their last 5 La Liga matches, Real remained 4 points behind leaders Barcelona, and fans are losing patience. Madrid were even booed off over the weekend after Sunday's 2-0 La Liga defeat by Celta Vigo, prompting an emergency meeting for the club's higher hierarchy to discuss Alonso's future. To get more on this, we're joined live from Madrid by Spanish football reporter and market journalist Juan Castro. Hola, Juan. Good morning.
Hola, good morning, buenos dias.
Buenos dias. Well, first, what is going on at Madrid, Juan? There is a dramatic slump for Real since beating rival Barcelona back in October.
Yes, the pressure is on Xabi Alonso, that is true. The pressure is on the coach, and people will look at him tonight in the match against Manchester City. So probably he's not the only responsible of this situation. Also, people and the press is looking to the players. But, you know, the rule of football is always the same, and it's easier to sack one person, the coach, rather than 25.
You talked about the Spanish press, Juan. How are Real Madrid fans reacting? Because in a club like this one, where not just winning but dominating is in the DNA, they have the reputation, the fans, to be quite impatient and unforgiving at times?
Yes, it's true. I mean, in Real Madrid, in Real ambience, let's say, if you lose 1, 2, 3 matches, it's a tragedy. That is clear. It's not a question that the Real Madrid has no possibilities in Champions League because they are in the top eight. It's not a question of they have no possibilities in the league because they are only 4 points behind Barcelona. But the sensation is that the team is not playing well, that the coach is not having in his hand the squad. And this sensation is terrible in the Bernabeu ambience. So that's the reason, because of tonight's pressure will be really high in Xavi Alonso.
Alonso arrived at Real in the summer offering quite a modern approach. He tried to impose his style. There are a lot of stars in that team. Do you believe it maybe lacks, because as you say, the focus is on the manager, but what about the team? Does this team lack a deep-lying maestro, a bit like a Luka Modric was, for example, for Real? Do they miss that at the moment?
Yeah, Luka Modric, Toni Kroos, all these kind of players, of course, Real Madrid miss them because there is not a playmaker. There is not a player who made the rest play. So that this is not the fault of Xabi Alonso. And of course, as you say, I think Bernabeu has to look at the players as well, because they don't run enough, they don't pressure enough, they are not feeling the responsibility to wear this tremendous historical shirt of Real Madrid. So yeah, I think also the players has to be real responsible of this situation.
Well, talking about the players, would you say, Juan, there is an Mbappe dependence, a sort of addiction, in the sense that if he's out of form, things don't quite work out for the team. If he doesn't score, nobody scores. It was a bit the case at PSG. I can tell you it's the same thing in the French national team. There's this kind of Mbappe dependence. Is it the same at Real Madrid?
Yeah, absolutely. The depends of depending of Mbappe is clear, but it's sad because I mean, you have not only Mbappe as a real star in Real Madrid. You have Vinicius, you have Jude Bellingham, you have Rodrigo. So there are other players who can score, who can assume the responsibility, but it's only Mbappe the one who is assume really this responsibility. And that's what the Real Madrid audience tonight, Bernabeu, have to say, that come on, Xabi Alonso is not the only responsible of this, but also the players.
And finally, Juan, do you believe tonight is Alonso's last chance to save his job at Valdebebas?
No. I think Real Madrid will win, and I think this situation will be solved at least for some days. But I do believe in Xabi Alonso work, in Xabi Alonso ability. So I don't think it will be the last game. But, you know, football is really difficult to predict.
Juan, thank you very much for being with us this morning. This was the Spanish football reporter Juan Castro. Real Madrid host Manchester City at the Bernabeu from 8 p.m. GMT tonight. And that's all your sport from me this morning.
Thank you for the sport, Sarah. Now, another 230 Kenyan police officers have arrived in Haiti as part of the UN-backed security force to tackle gang violence in the country. This new group is tasked with helping to combat the armed gangs that control much of the capital, Port-au-Prince, but also expand into central Haiti. This latest deployment brings the Kenyan contingent to nearly 1,000 officers. Kenyan forces were first sent to Haiti last year, and since their arrival there have been a number of Kenyan casualties. One was that of Benedict Kabiru, who was declared dead after an ambush in the Atinobite region in March. His family are still seeking answers about what happened to him. Haiti's transitional authorities acknowledged his death, and Nairobi has listed him among those killed in the line of duty. But his body has still not been recovered, and there's no confirmation of his remains. A little earlier in this program, his uncle and family spokesman, Daniel Kabiru Ndungu, joined us in the Nairobi studio. I asked him how his family has been coping with the uncertainty surrounding Benedict's death.
There's been a hectic 6-7 months. We initially were told that they're looking for him using the hands of the gangs, and he kept hope. Although there was no news, there was no information about it. how they were looking for him. But we kept hope that he's alive. But then when the President of the Republic of Kenya announced during a United Nations conference that Benedict is one of the casualties, we rushed to the headquarters. And we are told actually they confirmed that is true.
The police headquarters.
The police headquarters did confirm. And our question was, how come they have kept us in the dark? Yes, they would advise the President differently. And yes, we were trying to know how did our son die? What were the circumstances of his death? And actually when? And the other question is, are we able to get the remains so that we can be able to do the closure?
And when the President announced that at the UN conference, when all along your family had been perhaps hoping that he's still alive, how was it for you? How did you take it to receive the news that way, you know, through the media?
It was most insensitive to us. We felt really ambushed. We felt really harassed. And all along, we could not understand why they could not have and brief us on the position and give us the truth and keep us in suspense. The mother has been actually being on medication. It has been difficult for her to handle the matter. Actually, initially she used to pick the phone and call the son. They used to talk every day.
Hoping that at least somebody will answer.
You answer or somebody will take up the phone. So with the news, it was really hectic and devastating. And actually it's been all the much we can do to hold back and avoid that depression taking place, especially on her.
What have you learned so far about the circumstances surrounding his disappearance and subsequent death?
Well, when we felt we were being stonewalled, we also tried to use the court to find out if the police can give us the proper information. But actually even the court, they take time because on talk of submissions, they are not able to bring submission in time. And then the court case is again prolonged. It has been helpful. But all along, we've been visiting the office's headquarters at least once a week, twice a week. But every time we don't get any tangible information that we can really talk about.
So what do they say to you? What does the police headquarters or whoever you contact there say to you every time you show up to speak to them, to seek answers?
Initially, it used to be an active search and rescue mission in place. That was all along the message. Then when the report of his death came, now they're telling us they have a board that is done. They are supposed to investigate the circumstances in which he died. And the board is here to give us the findings. And then after the board, they're able to now move on to the next level.
What message would you like to give to the Kenyan government?
We must say we are very devastated and very sorry that they have been really mistreated us so much. They are not giving us the information we need. They are not giving us our son back so that we can be able to come to closure the matter. And they keep on waiting in suspense. It's almost now a year. And it's not been very easy for us. We look at the social media, we get different reports. We are not able to believe them or not. We are appealing to them to think of us as a family and to think of the parents, especially.
Have you received any official communication? Because you say you go in person to the police headquarters. Has there been any official communication to the family in writing?
And I must say that all along has been verbal. We go there. We meet the director of operations, and actually he gives us verbal communication, nothing written, nothing as official. But listen to the report, you come out, it will go through the attorney general, and now from there you can get documentation about the death, from which you're able to follow now up the matter next stage.
Daniel Kabirundungu speaking to me earlier here in the Nairobi studio. He's the uncle and family spokesperson of the family of the missing Kenyan police officer who was reportedly killed in Haiti. And William Woyer Dobor in Lofa County, Liberia, says that he thinks the Kenyan government needs to tell the family the truth about their son and also help the family. Now, early in the program, we talked about the social media ban on teenagers that has come into effect today in Australia, and companies face huge fines, but not parents or the children, James. But this is something that would concern parents, right? The social media use.
Yeah, without a doubt. I think parents will be monitoring that one pretty carefully to see how it all works out. Countries around the world too. But that's it for this edition of Newsday from Anne in Nairobi, me in London, and all our teams. Bye-bye.
More of the BBC World Service on the way next at midnight on KQED News.
Morning Edition takes you across this country and around the world with stories that keep you informed and the context to understand what matters. The news comes at you quickly, but we slow it down to examine each story from different angles and give perspective on what might happen next. A brand new day comes with new possibilities and a new edition of Morning Edition from NPR News.
Hey, listen Wednesday morning from 2 until 9 o'clock right here. Support for KQED comes from European Sleepworks, the store that bases its design and materials on research factors affecting sleep, including comfort and support, humidity levels, and ease of breathing. Details online about their mattresses and bedding at sleepworks.com. Michael State at midnight, KQED.